Hi, I'm Aranza Savas, a motivation researcher and coach, and I've dedicated the last 20 years to understanding how people create meaningful change in their lives. Today, I'm speaking with Disha Filya, who was nominated for the Uplifters podcast by the incomparable Clavis Natera, whose story you can hear on our show in episode 63. Disha's debut short story collection, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, literally swept every major literary award, winning the Penn Faulkner Award, the Story Prize, the LA Times Book Prize, and a finalist for the National Book Award. But beyond all the accolades, Disha has crafted something really extraordinary. Stories that give voice to the secret expansiveness of women who dare to be truer to themselves than to the rules. What strikes me most about Disha in this conversation is how she's turned her own journey of breaking free from expectations, both internal and external, into a real lesson in authentic living. In our conversation today, Disha shares what it looks like to interrogate the layers beneath things like writer's block or imposter syndrome, and why she believes that a writer's life requires saying no to fun things and saying yes to what matters most. We also talk about how losing her mother at 34 became a catalyst for refusing to spend her one precious life doing anything she didn't want to. Y'all, this conversation is so, so good and so full of incredible insights. And I'm so excited to share it with your friends. Thank you for joining us today.
Likewise. Thank you.
I loved your book.
Glad you did.
I feel like we've been hanging out for 2 days because I listened to it as an audiobook, which meant that we were just like girlfriends
just
who
talking.
Were hanging out, telling stories while I put together a new bookcase.
Oh, I love that.
Did some laundry, made some breakfast.
Church ladies are good company. They're good company.
Excellent company. So when did you know you were going to write about the secret lives of church ladies?
I feel like I've always been writing about that, myself being the first church lady. I wanted to write fiction first. That was my first impulse. But a lot of the characters and the ideas that came to me in that early efforts, it was really me fictionalizing some of the stuff that I was going through. And it was having done everything right, because I was, for the most part, a church girl. I followed all the rules, but I still wasn't happy. And I wasn't feeling the things that I had been taught that you should feel if you are a true evangelical Christian, because that's the tradition I had been raised in. But that tradition comes with a lot of guilt. I felt guilty for feeling that way. I should be grateful. And so writing fiction was my secret way of dealing with my dissatisfaction. I just gave it to these other women. I gave it to these characters. And a lot of those, the characters were drawn from my memory of the women that I had grown up with, women who were inside and outside of the church, who had always been very curious about how they navigated the world, given the church's restrictions and hypocrisies.
Yeah, definitely. As I read it, I asked myself what ties all these books together. And I wasn't sure whether it was just because it was what I was attuned to, or if it was indeed the core through line was this desire to expand beyond the limitations and to be truer to yourself than to the rules.
20 years ago when I started writing, I didn't start the stories that became church ladies until like 2013, 2014. But the church and women getting free and their expansiveness that you're talking about, the pursuit of that, that's just been consistent for the last, 25 or so years. And so I was writing short stories, and then in 2007, I got the idea for a novel. But I kept writing stories, and I was stalled on the novel. And then my ex-husband and I wrote a nonfiction book on co-parenting, and that's how I landed an agent. And my agent knew that I also had this novel that I've been working on for years. And so she's like, whenever you're ready, I'm ready to see that novel. And I kept stalling. And she was trying to help me. And she said, I like these church lady stories. And maybe you could build a collection around those themes that are in I think at that point I'd written two of the stories. And she said, you know, this around this theme of Black women, sex, and the Black church. And that felt more possible, more doable than finish this novel that I've been like schlepping around for so many years. And so that's what turned my attention and got me intentional about building a collection was my agent's advice.
I get the sense through this answer and through the book that you have broken out past expectations.
Yes.
Both external and internal, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways.
Yes. What you see in the stories, by the time I was writing those stories, I was not actively grappling with those things myself. But what was truest of me in those stories were the mother-daughter dynamics, which I had not intended to be so present, but clearly they wanted to be. My mother died of breast cancer in 2005. And thank you. And almost a decade point when I was starting to write the stories, there was still sort of unfinished business between my mother and myself that shows up in those stories. My mother was my biggest critic. She felt diminished by me. I remember one time I was in my 30s and she said, I finally figured out the word to describe how you've made me feel your whole life. And I'm like, I don't think I want to hear this, right? And she said, intimidated.
Oh,
what do you do with that?
Yeah. I mean, it creates an opportunity for some empathy. What she was saying is it was her own that allowed her to be intimidated. As you talk about your mother, it makes me think back to something I think about a lot, honestly. I hadn't ever heard it until a guest early on in the show said it. And she was quoting another writer who says, teach from your scars, not your wounds.
Ooh, yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And it sounds like you were largely writing about scars at that point.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you for giving me that language.
It's pretty powerful.
Because I never wanted to imply like, oh, those are not my issues. It's just like, it wasn't actively at the moment, but it's because it was scar. It was not an open wound.
Open seeping mess.
Yeah.
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 So let's talk about some of the ways you have moved beyond expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I'm curious how much of the expectation came from you mm-hmm. and from others.
It was odd because I was sent to church.
So in other words, like your family wasn't going with you.
Right. But
same.
They sent me at an early age, like too same. Late for us, but she can be salvaged kind of situation.
Same.
What was that?
I don't know. I mean, my grandparents were raising me mm-hmm. and I think they were like, we have done that showing up for church thing already.
You
so
go.
Just send the child.
What? That's why. Okay. It's so rare that I meet people who have had that experience, but yeah. So that was my experience. And so it's not like I had any kind of like fire and brimstone being preached at me at home. And I was a good girl. I followed the rules. I got good grades. My nose was always in a book. I didn't give anybody any trouble. And so the expectations weren't necessarily around churchy things. What I got from my mom, and I think this was the whole intimidation thing, was that I dared to be a different person than she was. And because of her wounds, which were not scars, she took that personally. So if I didn't like what she liked, then she felt judged by me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the expectations she had of me that were pressure were things that I considered really superficial. And so I was frustrated and I was hurt by how critical she was of me. I think I realized early on, it was impossible to make her happy. I would have to be a whole other person. It was things like other girls, their moms were like, don't wear makeup. This would have been the 80s, right? And so girls my age were like sneaking in the bathroom at school, putting on makeup, taking it off before they went home. My mother was like glamour girl. She wanted me to wear makeup and I didn't want to wear makeup.
Mm.
She was very much, what are people going to say? People are going to talk about you if I didn't iron my shirt. And so these were the things my mother cared about. Mm-hmm. I could care less. And so when she couldn't convince me that these things mattered, then she would like shame me. Right. And so my 13th birthday, she wanted to buy me makeup and a makeup bag and take me shopping. And she was so excited. And I was like, I don't want that.
I feel like you were going to go to Claire's and glamour shots at the mall in this scenario.
Right. Which was my mother's thing, not my thing. And she just kept like building it up, hyping it up. And I was like, no, no. And I was like, I would just like some books. And she's like, that's boring. She just kept insisting. And I kept saying no. And then finally she said, you should wear makeup, which to say to a 13-year-old girl is devastating. And it just made me feel even more insecure and self-conscious than I already did. And so from stuff like that, it was really my own expectations that sort of led me to do the things that I did. I wanted to go to college. On my dad's side, I had an uncle that went to college, but otherwise it was me. No one on my mom's side that I was aware of had gone to college. So I knew I wanted to go to college. I knew I did not want to stay in Florida. My mom and my grandmother lived together their entire lives. I knew I needed to get out of that house and not live there again. And so I started sort of setting those things up for myself. And then in the back of my mind were the church's expectations, because that's what indoctrination is. I've been going to church as long as I could remember. And so even though I wasn't always beholden and I didn't carry a lot of the shame that like a lot of girls had around having had premarital sex, it just over time, it was just sort of, oh, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing, this sort of vague sense of it. But I'm grateful for that, because I think for a lot of women and Black women in particular, that fear of condemnation in the afterlife, but also the condemnation they got on in this life, it really broke them, their bodies, their spirits, or both. And so I never had to contend with that, because something just never added up for me with Christianity. But I never felt like, until I was in my 30s and I got divorced, I never felt like I could say that out loud. And one of the things that came out of my mom dying as young as she did at 52, and I was 34, and my grandmother died that same year, I was like, I just don't have time to not do the things I want to do.
When you had that realization and sort of catalyzing moments, right? They're so powerful that take us from inaction to action. What did you decide to focus on?
5 years before my mom died, that was around the time where I was like really writing in earnest and wanting to figure out how do you get published and all of these things. And then the same time.
Did you identify as a writer, or were you a reader who wrote?
I had started to identify as a writer sort of gradually, nervously, because I had these ideas that like until I published or published in a big name publication, I wasn't a real writer. But thankfully, I started to meet mentors, and one in particular, Toni Norman, who was like, you're already a writer. And so it was in those early 2000s when I was, you know, starting that process, starting writing. And then in 2005, the same year that my mom died and my grandmother and my father, actually, that's a whole other story, I got separated and then we divorced the following year. So now I had been a stay-at-home mom. So it was like, oh, I've got to, you know, figure out how to make a living. And I thought, I'm going to try and make a living at this. And I had a little bit of a launching pad because I had been a stay-at-home mom. I was getting child support and alimony. And then my mom had, you know, money that she left me. So that helped for a time. It helped me survive for almost a decade. I mean, I was doing other work and I was still earning money, but that cushion helped a lot. It allowed me to even be able to think that I wanted to make a living as a writer. And so it was, okay, so I'm going to try and make a living at this. There's nothing else I want to do. And if I'm going to do this, I'm going to write what I want to write. Because again, it's like, why spend the one life I get doing something I don't want to do? I want to write. And then why spend that time writing something that makes other people happy, or, you know, is playing scared or is playing safe? I'm not going to do that either.
That was a pretty bold move though, right? To feel that responsibility for another human being for just a matter of survival on your own. Mm-hmm. And to say, I'm going to bet on my my gifts and my passion, there had to have been moments that were scary in there. How did you keep, how did you keep showing up for yourself again and again?
In the midst of so much uncertainty and, you know, in, as you know, in writing, publication, there's just rejection. No one goes into writing to get rich. You know, you usually have to do other work. So I was doing a lot of freelancing and just sort of piecing together what I call a patchwork quilt of income. And it was just never enough. But I kept doing it because I didn't want to do anything else. And I had the idea that what I really wanted to do most was to publish a book of fiction. First, it was this novel I had been working on since 2007. And then my agent convinced me to shift gears to the short story in it. And so it became a singular focus, finish the book, depending on what year it was, which book am I talking about? And I'm doing all these other jobs. I'm raising children. I got remarried. I got divorced again. But I never gave up on the book. When the novel wasn't working, I pivoted to a short story collection. So I think the short answer to your question was having that singular focus of, I know exactly what I want to do. There's nothing else I want to do but this thing. And if the way I'm going about it isn't working, I'll pivot and come at it a different way.
One of the things that strikes me is there's a massive difference between saying you're writing a work of fiction and actually carving out time day after day after year after year and fitting that into all the other things that life involves.
Yes. And sticking with it even when you're not writing every day. Because I have never been a writer that writes every day. Just haven't.
So what does that look like for you to stick with it through the ebbs and the flows?
Yes. One thing is just always being honest with myself. I don't believe in, for myself, things like writer's block or imposter syndrome. Like those things.
You don't believe in them?
They're layers. They are just the first layer. They are the first layer. And you're like, oh, I'm blocked. Okay, well, what is the block? And let's keep going. Oh, the block is that time when I was in fifth grade and my teacher told me that I couldn't speak to her until I was perfect. Oh, so that's where this perfectionism comes from. Okay. Or imposter syndrome. Who am I? Da, da, da. And it's because I'm afraid of outshining this person because we have this dysfunctional relationship that depends on me playing small. There's always something. But when we stop at writer's block or imposter syndrome, we're not interrogating it. And when you interrogate it and it's an actual thing that you can address, either in therapy or in some other way, then it becomes a movable object. You don't have to be stuck behind it because it's this sort of vague thing. It's something very specific. So that's helped that when I have been stuck, it's like, I need to problem solve this. And so a lot of times when I was stuck on the novel, having an agent who could help me kind of troubleshoot some things. I've always had people in my corner and knowing when you need what. Sometimes just to keep going, you need a cheerleader, somebody who is like, they just love you and they love everything you write. And then and you're like, I don't want to give up because I want to be who you think I am.
Yes.
But those people are not good critique partners. So sometimes you need a critique partner to say, I think that this is why this character or this thing isn't working or why you're stuck on this novel and you can actually do some like real troubleshooting. So you need both of those kinds of people in your life. Writers, we do our work in isolation, but I've been finding ways to work alone together. So having critique partners over the years, being part of writers groups, going to writers retreats and conferences, doing co-working sessions on Zoom with other writers where we come on, we say hello, and we just start working. And if people come into the room, we say hi in the chat, and then we go back to work. And everybody's doing their own thing. It's something about having some where you feel like you're with someone, even if they're in on another continent. Mm-hmm. It's just something about that that can be the motivation you need at a particular moment.
I'm a huge believer in that. I host a co-working session every Friday morning that I call the cocoon. And it's for the folks who sponsor this podcast, mm-hmm. and we all just get on, and people do vastly different things. Mm-hmm. One woman's going to be organizing her paperwork, mm-hmm. while another woman is going to be writing her novel, yes. while another's writing to all of her clients, right? Yes. You know, it's like vastly different stuff, but mm-hmm. we come in and we just get clear with each other, and we look each other in the eye and say, yes. this is what I'm going to focus on for the next 45 minutes.
Yes.
Then we take a break to get mm-hmm. out of our heads and into our bodies. And we do a one song dance party.
Oh, I love it.
Highly recommend. And then we go back in mm-hmm. to the cocoon for an hour. And it just blows my mind every time mm-hmm. how just the power of supportive accountability
yes.
shifts yes. the way that we show up for ourselves and what really matters.
Absolutely. I'm thinking about my friend, Tammy Winfrey Harris. We've been friends almost 20 years now. That's wild to me. And we started doing this thing called free range. And it was usually weekend. So we would say free range Saturday or free range Sunday. I don't know the connection between not having on a bra and calling that free range. But one of us said, like, let's have a video call and catch up this weekend. And somebody said, well, I'm not going to have on a bra. And another was like, me neither. And so we just call it free range. I don't know. And so... it's the similar dynamic with yours that like somebody's cleaning out their fridge or cabinets or answering email or, you know, whatever it is, but we're doing it alone together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't remember who it is. My mom always says that she heard some 1950s movie star mm-hmm. say that that was her favorite hobby mm-hmm. was having a friend come over and clean house with her. It was exactly what you and I did mm-hmm. today. You mm-hmm. didn't know about it, but I did. Yeah. I cleaned and did laundry. You mm-hmm. hung out with me and told me stories and you made it fun.
Yeah. That's what we're supposed to do.
We're not supposed to be all alone.
So much of separate and like human history was women collectively taking care of homes and children and all of those things. That's not to say that I'm saying that women are naturally good at that or that they should. But when women were doing those tasks, often it was with other women. And I think when we're doing that work, we're not meant to do it in isolation. When I was a stay-at-home mom, there were some women who would do this thing where I come to your house with my kids and with other moms. And like some moms are watching the kids and the other moms are cleaning that one house. And then we go to someone else's house. And I think we've gotten so far away from that. Everybody's all in their own little box.
What you said about your free range thing is the other session we have every week. So every Monday, I get this group of women together and we just set our intentions for the week.
I love that.
While we do the thing. So yes. it's like, if I want to eat healthy for the week, I am meal prepping and
yes.
like getting all the vegetables peeled while I talk to these ladies.
Yes, that's it.
It's like, bring some pleasure to this stuff. And I think that's true for anything hard.
Yep. And I do it now. Sometimes it's not even in a communal way, but I think just for time management purposes, talking, you know, just catching with friends, I'm usually doing some housework when that's happening, or I'm going for a walk or something, you know, something that doesn't require a lot of brain power for me so I can actually listen to my friends. But I'm multitasking, taking the time to cook myself a meal while I'm talking to a friend.
I think the misunderstanding about multitasking is people say now they're like, oh, it's impossible to multitask. Yes, it is impossible to do two things that are the same at once.
Right.
So I can't process yes. words on my laptop and words on the movie screen simultaneously.
Right.
Because it's using the same part of my brain. But to use my hands while using my ears, oh, that we are actually hardwired to do.
Yes. Yes. I never thought about it like that. Yeah. Makes perfect sense.
It turns on more centers of our brain so we can be more creative. We can right. be more connected. We can listen more deeply.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. And we're busy.
Yes.
So like, let's maximize it.
Yes.
So you've created this book. You've written the thing.
Mm-hmm.
What was the process of advocating for it to become a thing like for you?
I've been really lucky. My agent sold them both. And the harder sell was the first one was Church Ladies. Nobody wanted it except West Virginia University Press. And I'm so thankful, you know, that they had a vision for it and they saw, you know, what it could be and they really believed in it. and nobody else did. I was fully prepared to self-publish that book, though, if nobody did, because I was like, I finished this book. I finished it. Like, wow. Well, no, I hadn't finished it. It was finished enough to go out on submission. I had 6 written. So it wasn't done, but it was more than I had ever accomplished. And so it wasn't an easy sell. I didn't get a huge advance by any stretch of the imagination, but it was successful in terms of how it was received, in terms of getting award and things like that.
Your book got like every possible award a book could get.
Everyone.
It
got 3 big ones and it was a finalist for the National Book Award. You know, that's just those.
Freaking bonkers.
Yes, it truly bonkers. Yes, yes, yes.
So like, what was your role in making that happen beyond writing that?
Nothing. And I want to just emphasize that this business is not a meritocracy. All we can do is our best work on the page. Everything that happens after that is luck, marketing and promotion, and timing, and all of that. So all things that writers can't control. My advice is always for writers to just, you gotta love this, because the writing part of this is the only thing you can control. And your happiness and your sense of yourself and success can't be tied up on outcomes that you have no control over. Did you write a story that you love? Awesome. That to me, I've succeeded now. I've written a book that I love. I hope other people love it too. But what happens after that, I have no control over it. And then the second part of that is then to be on to the next project and not just sort of sitting around waiting and hoping, well, what's going to happen with this? And just always be working on something new. And that's the multitasking thing too, you know, working on multiple projects at once.
Yeah. And I think that can be really hard when one thing feels sort of wrapped or finished to get back into that groove. So many of us get what we call post-marathon blues. You make the thing, you get the agent, you finish the book, you get the award, and then it's like, boom, boom, boom. Like, what now?
Maybe it's because I have the multiple things that I don't finish one thing and then start another. I finish one thing and now I get to do this other thing that I've also been working on. So like when I turned in the manuscript for Church Ladies and it wasn't going to come out for another year, I turned it in and then I was so excited. I was like, I think I know how to write this novel now. So I wasn't starting something new. I was like getting to finally go back to something that had eluded me at that point for 13 years. And so I was like diving right into it. I then sold that book 2 summers ago. But at the same time, I've been working on television projects. So when I'm not working on the novel, it's not like then I'll start working on it. Like I'm working on both of them at the same time. So there's not that moment of, I already have an idea for another novel. I have another short story collection that I sold as a partial when we sold the novel that comes out the following year. So I got to get back into that as well. And then there's a YA novel idea that I have like 8 pages of written. So it's like, these things are waiting for me to come back, you know? So I feel like it's like next, next, next.
What do you say to yourself about having all these projects, right? Because I think there's a part of our brains that can be like, I should be working on everything, or, oh, I should be the person who focuses on just one thing all the time.
Oh, no, because I've decided and figured out I'm not that person. I overwhelm myself easily. And so I used to make these like massive to-do lists that were broken down by like, this week, here are all the things that I'm going to do. And then I would get to Monday and not finish any of those things and then feel like a failure. I spent so much time making the schedule and I didn't do any of the things on the schedule. So I did that for years and it was just like whack-a-mole. I'm just bouncing from thing to thing. And so then I just started doing something a little different. I have a calendar like everybody has, but I also have my schedule, which is a Google Docs, and it's organized by day of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, like that. And so under Monday, it's like all these Mondays throughout the rest of the year, and in some cases, like next year based on the date. and I have the things that I want to do. And I'd made a more reasonable expectation of myself. So I realized I'm not going to get 7 things done. Mm-hmm. Let me put 2. And then if I get those 2 done, what's on Tuesday? I'll start that. That never happens though. But what I also started doing was showing myself grace, which is, let's say I had 3 things for Monday and I got 2 done. I can move that thing to Tuesday, Wednesday, another day. I can move it to the next Monday.
Mm, that's so good.
But it was something about moving it to another slot so that I can, at the end of Monday, say, everything that was listed on Monday has been taken care of. It was either done or I have scheduled time to do it another day, but it's gone. And today I did everything that I needed to do today. Mm-hmm. It's just something about that sort of visual that took so much pressure off. Now, of course, that means I look at multiple calendars, but that doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. My brain works like that better than a single calendar with things on it on that day. And then I'm like constantly looking at, you know, all these things where it's like, no, I'm just looking at my Mondays. Now I'm looking at my Tuesdays.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I call them my big rocks every week. And I really try to think at the beginning of the week, like, okay, there's like a billion little things that are going to distract me, that are going to want my attention, mm-hmm. that are going to feel urgent.
Yes.
But what really matters?
Yes. That's the big question.
And I think so much of your life now has been built to answer that question for yourself. So it's like the mountain was chosen. And then the boulders were defined. And then now you're at the stage of the rocks. And so then, that means some pebbles are going to support the rocks and some pebbles are going to get flicked off into the ocean.
Yep. Those are what I noticed too, is that when I started being more willing to disappoint people, you know, and willing to say no to good things. Like, it's easy to say no to like bad or stupid things, but like saying no to like a good thing or a good person, because that's the only way I can say yes to the things I want to do. And like, it's hard right now, but you know, 6 months from now, Deisha is going to thank me that I said no. So I didn't have to be at this thing that I didn't want to be at anyway. And it's not even, I need to be home doing my work or I need to be home doing laundry. Sometimes it's, I need to be home doing nothing. Mm-hmm. Like literally being willing to choose to do nothing over being somewhere that I don't want to be, or being somewhere where it's just going to be back to back to back. Like, I try not to rush. I hate rushing. I hate the way I feel when I'm rushing. And so like rushing from one thing to the next or whatever, I try not to schedule myself like that. And so sometimes I can't do things because in order to do it, I'd have to rush. So I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to do it.
And I think for so many of us, the reason we say yes is just because we've always said yes.
Yes.
And like, we don't even know how to say no. And we say yes so quickly that then it's like takes 80,000 more steps to figure out how to undo the yes.
Yes, it's right. Right.
So then it's like, I might as well just say yes.
Yes, might as well just do it. Yeah.
Exactly. So how did you slow that down for yourself?
It goes back to that, I get this one life. And so it was, you know, what are the things I absolutely have to do? And especially when you're raising kids, your life and your free time is driven by their schedules. Mm-hmm. But having a co-parenting situation, I had a schedule where there were times where my children were not with me and they were not my responsibility. And so it was like, okay, now am I going to use that time and get my work done? Or am I going to like farm it out to people who want something from me? Mm-hmm. And so being able to
help them get the thing done that they want done.
Their projects and things.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I ever like conquered it, other than maybe conquering the fear of, if I say no to this thing and it's a little bit of money, but I want to keep that relationship, but it's not enough money to make it worth my while. And just trusting at a certain point, not all money is good money. And if it's not worth my time, just trusting that I'll figure it out somewhere else. Need to say no to this, or I need to let this person be upset with me.
I actually think those questions you just asked so specifically are relatable for most people. Mm-hmm. Is this what really matters? Is this what matters right now? Mm-hmm. What's the trade-off here?
Yes, there's always a trade-off. There's always a trade-off. And being willing to think about, because I'm good about saying no to things that are asked of me at the last minute. Now, sometimes I say yes. Sometimes it's just like on a lark. I try to be more spontaneous because I'm not. But most of the time, it'll be like something in the future. And it seems harmless enough to say yes, but I've learned enough. I've had been through this enough to know I'm going to love that when that day comes, I don't have to do all of that. Mm-hmm. And also deciding that I don't want to is a valid enough reason for me. Mm-hmm. And that I don't owe anybody else an explanation for why I don't do something. I only have to answer to myself. And so if I'm like, I just don't want to. Okay, well, I'm not going to.
Yeah. I mean, I have to temper my I don't want to sometimes, because I know that sometimes they are just me wanting to stay comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of temper them with, will this help me grow in some way? Right. Yeah. Because I do want to grow. Yeah. I do want to challenge myself. I do want to expose myself to new experiences. It all just boils down to slowing the damn yes down.
Yes. And does it fit? Because, you know, you're saying yes to that thing that makes you uncomfortable because it fits some larger thing you want to, how you want to live your life. But me doing something just because somebody wants me to do it, because what I'm uncomfortable with most of the time is like social situations. Like I would much prefer to be at home.
Clavis nominated you for the Uplifters.
Thank you, Clavis.
And oh, she's amazing. And here's what she said. She says, Deesha has done so much to break down the barriers that keep BIPOC writers from accessing channels to publication. She is also incredibly talented as a writer, fearless in her work, and bold in her portrayal of complicated women in her books. She's brilliant, funny, and a true literary citizen.
Oh my God. Thank you, Clavis.
I mean, there's nothing that feels better than being admired by the people we admire.
And I admire her so deeply. She just, there's, in addition to her tremendous talent, like I always say, I love when good books are written by good people because it's not always the case. But with Clavis, you get both. And there's such a graciousness, the way she moves in the world. This business can be a little hard scrabble at times. And she's just so above it all. And so I'm always trying to like be like her. Mm. And she is also funny and truly like subversive.
Yes, she is.
She's the wildest.
She's a radical woman.
Yes, truly, truly. Like, do not get it twisted. And so we just have some of the best times.
I'm curious what she's talking about in that first sentence when she says that you've done so much to break down barriers that keep BIPOC writers from accessing channels to publication. What's she referencing there?
I try not to hoard information. I'm always sharing resources and opportunities with people. If you've ever been in my classes or mentee, like I'm always sending you things. We're not one and done. Now that I have Substack, I've been trying to use that as a way to make sure that especially emerging writers, especially BIPOC writers, know the opportunities that are there. We always talk about speaking people's names in rooms. Mm. I try and do that whenever I can. And also passing along opportunities, right? So if I pass on something, if I have the opportunity to recommend or nominate someone else, I do that. And finally, I consider judging like competitions and literary prizes to be a kind of community service. The judging panel needs to look as be as diverse as the submissions that we get. So even though it takes away from my time with my own work, I've been doing a lot of judging and a lot of reading. I've done so much now that I've started to see like some the same writers, you know, popping up and I feel like I know them. And so it's like, oh, I remember this person. They didn't make the final cut for this thing, but here they are again with this, either the same story or different story. And just seeing people's trajectories that way is really exciting for me. People talk about it like a ladder. People like Kiese Layman climbed a ladder. He didn't pull it up after himself. He left it down so people like me could climb up. And so we leave it down so that other people can climb up. So I think that's what she meant.
That's really, really beautiful. I hear in that how you are in these roles playing both the cheerleader and the critique partner.
Yes.
And creating the containers to for community and interrogation and all of these aspects that were so in service for you.
Yeah. And I try to be as accessible as I can. And unfortunately, again, I have to balance with my own work. but I tend to be responsive when people reach out on social media as much as I can. And so someone took a workshop with me once, and then he reached out and said, he asked me for feedback. And I said, I don't have the bandwidth to do that. But if you sign up and take a workshop with me, that's a way that I could be available to you to give feedback. So he signed up, took another workshop with me. And the next thing I know, he was going to get his MFA. And then the next thing I know, I'm judging a contest and there's his submission. And it was really wonderful. I shouldn't say like I was surprised. I just want to make it clear. I didn't choose him just because he was tenacious, but it does matter that he's tenacious.
Yes.
And so now he's going to be published in this anthology. And then he reached out to me the other day to say he got an agent.
Oh.
I love witnessing that. So I couldn't give him what he initially asked for. And for the vast majority of people, I can't be a reader for them, but I can be an encourager. I can be a resource. I can be a connector.
I love that. And there's so many levels to it that I think teach us about this practice. And one is, of course, from your seat, being able to say, I'm going to give you an answer that is true to my capacity and offers you an alternative.
Yes.
Right. And that is how we set healthy, helpful boundaries that feel good.
Yes.
Rather than just shutting down and saying no and then feeling closed off. Mm-hmm. And then from his perspective, you know, how many of us have been afraid to ask for help, to ask the person we admire to support us, afraid that they'll say no and then, wow, we'll feel rejected and we should stop writing.
Right.
But I think what we hear from his side of this story is ask the question. You may not get exactly the answer you expect, but you actually may get something that's more sustaining.
Right.
Yeah. Really, really wonderful lessons in there. I am so excited to have met you. I'm so excited to read the novel when it comes out.
I can't wait for you to read it.
In these short stories, and I'm like, oh, I'm like, I want to meet these people. I want to see who they are and how they love.
Yeah. Well, this one is going to be funny. It still has some serious themes. It's still poking at the church, but the True Confessions of First Lady Freeman has a lot of laughs in it as well. I think you'll have fun.
I know I will. I know I will. As uplifters, we love to lift others. So how can we as a community...
Follow me on Substack, because one of the things that I include...
I'm so bullish on Substack. I'm obsessed.
One of the things that I try to include in every newsletter are pre-orders for usually debut writers. Not always, but usually.
That's awesome, Deesha.
Yeah, I just put the book cover, and sometimes if I have time, I can put a little description. But usually, sometimes it's just the book cover and the link to bookshop.org, because then you're also supporting indie bookstores when you use Bookshop. And it just makes it easy for people to pre-order.
I love that. That's such a great idea. And I will totally do that. Mm-hmm. Who do you want to nominate as an uplifter?
I nominate Mahogany L. Brown.
Tell me why.
Oh my gosh. So she's just, first of all, she's legendary. I knew of her before I ever got to know her, and as I do now, as a friend, as a sister. So I knew her work, which she is one of one. She is genre bending. You know, she's in the YA space. She's in the poetry space. She's in the adult fiction space, because she is a storyteller.
Mm.
And it's her heart that's on the page. And so I knew her as a woman with a very loving, generous heart and just a phenomenal storyteller before I knew her as a person. But as I mentioned, like, you know, it could be those good books, but are they good people? She is everything that Clavis said about me supporting writers. Mo does that exponentially and is eternally gracious, patient, insightful. She has a vision, and she's just bringing people along and beyond the literary world. You know, she'll bring musicians and writers together. She took her residency at Lincoln Center, which was initially short term, and it's now become this multi-year commitment. And there are so many of us who can say we stood on a Lincoln Center stage because of mahogany. And so I describe her, and you imagine this person who is larger than life, and she is, but she also has a tender heart. And you don't always get that. You don't always get a person who's still in touch with being kind and being thoughtful. Also funny, hilarious, hilarious. And just, you know, just a genius on the page and a genius on the stage.
Amazing. Amazing. I can't wait to meet her.
I'm excited. I'm excited.
Thank you so much, Disha, for your story, your work, your wisdom, and all that you're doing in the world.
Thank you. This has been such a fun conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the Uplifters in your life. And then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more uplifters, and it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwell in the perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. 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 Lift you up.
In the pre-chorus, right?
I was like...
Mommy, stop crying. Mommy, stop crying. You're disturbing the peace.